Jamie.
How's it going, man?
It's going really good, dude. How are you doing?
Doing all right. It's a long day, a lot of driving.
Wow, this is a great way to climb mountains and come down, you know.
For our reception, our Vulcan buddies brought acid.
I was dropping in and snaking people and causing shit. I remember calling on the radio, and I'm like, Brushy, where are you? You know,
Greg would do the tricks. He was kind of like the Tony Hawk of snowboarding.
I mean, people just really gravitated to the backcountry.
I liked Greg, but he didn't really care for me too much because I was a little shithead.
Welcome to the final episode of the second season of the F and Rad Snowboarding Podcast. I'm Eric Charlson. It's been an amazing year with amazing guests, and we want to thank every single one of them very much. Before we get to today's episode, I wanted to say an extra special thank you to Russell Winfield, who kicked off season two. I called him today to ask him about his new pro model on Offshore Shapes. So tell me all that you can tell me about Offshore Shapes. How did you get set up with those dudes?
I found out that they made custom boards, and so I just emailed the dude, and I was like, how much would you charge me to build me a custom snowboard? Mm-hmm. He's like, is this the Russell Winfield who I thought? I was like, yeah, man, that's me. They were building their boards in Australia, but the guy he was building them with really didn't want to take the next step to the next level. So Josh and Richie, the two dudes who own Offshore, decided to buy some land in Seiko because they'd been going there for like 15, 20 years or something. So they bought this land, built this super dope factory. I brought in Paul McGinty, who was like the mastermind at Ride. So like all the technology that Ride and K2 now use was all shit that he fucking designed and fucking brainchilded. So we've got really good technology, and he's now like the senior chain supply manager at Tesla.
Whoa.
So they're epic. They're radical dudes. We're all on the same level. The team's rad. Like a lot of companies out there put an image out, and they're not really that image. You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
At Offshore, it is what it is, man. We're fucking hand-building, super high-tech, freestyle powder snowboards in the Seiko. I walk like 100 yards from the factory, and I get on a chairlift at Moiwa and ride powder.
Oh, my
I can ride
God.
Powder all the way back into the door of the factory.
It's good pow there, yeah?
No, it's real, dude. I got fucking black room, not white room. I got black room. I went completely under on this heel turn.
Oh,
in this
man.
Gully. I was like, ooh, it was epic. They're not in it for fucking the wrong reasons. You know, not that we all don't want to make a little dough so we can fucking feed our kids and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Not out there trying to throw $2 million parties and like high side and shit.
So tell me about the board design. How did you...
I've had it, the idea, since when I had my falling out with Ride. This shape, it's pretty close to my shape that never came out at Ride. Everybody kind of looks at it and is like, fuck, that thing looks backwards. It's got a pin tail and a round nose. It's a directional twin. Side cut is centered. Nose and tail are the same length and height, but the tail is pinned. And what that does is it allows the tail to drain in the powder like a tapered board does. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And yet you can ride it in reverse. So you don't got to freaking, you know, you don't got to like do any weird shit. Like when you ride a tapered board going switch, it feels a little weird or you're like, it's a little sketchy. It's not like that. You can land switch in powder. You can ride it in the park. You can ride it in the summer. And I went, like, Josh, the designer, he's kind of a savant, man. He, like, I gave him my nose and tail shape and kind of told him the theory that I was trying to achieve, and he was like, okay, and he just put it together.
That's awesome. What did you put inside the board?
Birch Core 3-strip carbon array X on the nose and the tail.
Nice.
So that, like, if you get forward on it, it'll throw you back in between your bindings. And then I got these things called sushi rods. It's like little pop rods, kind of. And then it's 750 glass on the top and 6-something on the bottom. So it's super high tech, man, but it's not like stupid tech. It's tech that works. Yeah, I wrote it on groomers. You know, it's Japan, dude. They got freaking groomer figure eight teams out there and shit. So there's always groomers to try stuff on.
Cool.
And I wrote it in the, you know, the choppy snow. It works great, man. It's the best board I've ever snowboarded on.
And if I would have told you, you're going to have a pro model next year. Would you have believed me?
I'd have been like, sweet, where's it coming from? You know? Yeah. I mean, it's like, you never know, man. Yeah, I mean, the whole line is so sick. All of the boards are so good and so well thought out. You know, construction to shape to graphics. Like, even the P-Tex, there's no bullshit. Like, there's no gimmick. Just real snowboards.
Dude, so where can people check these out?
You can see the old shapes, which are kind of like the new stuff besides mine, at offshoresnowshapes.com.
Perfect.
And check your local core snowboard shop. It's going to be a limited number this year. It's going to be a bit more expensive. They're not going to be anywhere near as expensive as the Gentums, I don't think. You know, this is all top-of-the-line stuff. This is, like, really nice, really thought out, cared for, hand-shaped, you know, by snowboarders. I hope it catches, man. It's real.
So if you're listening to the podcast, get your local shop to carry Russell's board. And then buy the board and then ride it.
You'll love it.
All right. Our guest this week is Jamie Lynn. What can I say about Jamie Lynn? I mean, he's one of the most styly pro riders that's ever existed in snowboarding. He's had a 20-plus year pro career on LibTech. You know, he's a pro's pro. My hometown buddy Mike Strato works for Vans and knows Jamie pretty well. So I have to thank Strats for setting this interview up. A few weeks ago, Jamie was in Jackson Hole for a while before going up to Baldface with Volcom. I reached him as he arrived in Revelstoke after driving from Caslow in terrible weather. Sadly, he was in Revelstoke for a funeral. What's going on with the funeral? That sounds not so great.
You know, a guy that we came to know over the last couple of years at the Baldface, a kid named Niall, died in a car wreck like 3 days ago.
I don't even know what to say. It sucks.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a heavy deal. We had him, he was our tail guy all last week when we were up there, and we shared the most incredible days of powder that I've ever had, you know, and just going from such a high to just poof and life's gone just like that. It's pretty heavy. But it's, you know, such is life.
Yeah, man.
That's why you just can't take any moment for granted, and it's so precious and sacred, and just got to be present. Can't let it slip.
Again, I don't even know what to say.
But today just, today just reinforces all that, you know. Makes you just stoked that you're still doing it, still alive, and thankful for the time shared with the cat. Yeah. How have you been? How are things on your end?
Dude, everything's been good. This year's been insane. When you show up in my Facebook feed, the guys that comment on pictures of you, like Devin Walsh, you know what I mean? He's like, snowboard god. I'm like, when Devin Walsh calls you a snowboard god, it's incredible. And actually, speaking of Devin, when I first moved out here in 93, Devin was still in high school and was just getting started. He was still on barfoot. And I can remember him and his crew idolizing you in such a big way. Like, they were wearing white toques because you wore a white toque in some photo. They did a whole season without gloves because they saw a photo of you with no gloves, you know?
You guys are too kind, man. You know, how you digest what you take in from all of the people that you look up to, you know, everybody has that. I have the same inspirations and same peers that I put posters up on my wall and said, one of these days I'm going to be able to do it like that. And you strive for it and you work towards it. I think it's how you digest that and how it comes out. I mean, that's your individual style. That's just the way it is. It's, you can try to, you know, do it in a different manner, but it really comes down to, that's you. It's truth, but there's beauty in that truth. And everyone, I think, everyone has a valid individual style, regardless of how it's placed in society or judged, you know.
That's rad to hear.
But that's
you
just
say
where
that.
I'm, you know, where I come from.
That's super dope, dude. Who were the guys that you would put posters up? Was it skateboarders? Was it snowboarders?
Yeah, I mean, always kind of, Hosoi was, of course, in the 80s for me, someone that was a big influence, but also Gons, Chris Miller with his lean 360 methods on the vert ramp is something that I tried to emulate on the snowboard as close as I could. But with snowboarding, I think, you know, Palmer and Kidwell, you know, are two guys that, and Craig being so close, you know, having him grow up in our backyard and watch him develop at our local ski area at night, bashing gates to train for World Cup stuff, you know. But as far as the style, it was always, you know, being able to kick out a method air like Palma or like Kidwell at the Tahoe quarter pipe.
Rad.
You know, and, or Cab off of Fly Ramp, you know, Bones Brigade, Jesse Martinez, you know, those kind of guys that I always looked at. They just put in a little extra English on what they did because they could.
Yeah.
And if you can and you don't, you're blowing it.
So going right back to the beginning, do you remember what the first board you rode was?
My first snowboard that I got my feet on was a Backhill Burton 140. And it was sitting in the corner of a skateboard shop I was working in between 12 and 13 years old, putting grip tape on boards in the back of the shop. And instead of getting paid for a day's wage, I'd ask if I could borrow a snowboard for the weekend. And then end up hitchhiking a ride up to the mountain, got up there way too early, way before the trailers even opened, and hiked up the side of the lift a couple times just to try to figure it out. But by the time the lift opened, I was ready to go.
Nice.
Had funky Fast X buckles. Thing was so janky.
So it was just perfect. You by yourself kind of thing?
Yeah, I got a ride up there with two guys that were older brothers, schoolmates, that they were skiers, and their dad was dropping them off before work, which meant like 7:30 at the mountain.
Wow.
So I had a couple hours to try to hike up, and it was a good day. It was kind of 6-7 inches of powder, soft enough to go easy on my ass, and enough to get my edges working. But then I made it up to the top of the mountain and came halfway down, and I stopped for a moment. And this kid, Mike Rankin, came up. I'd known him from skateboarding, and he dropped in and hit this backside hit right in front of me and did the sickest method air from that day forward. Like, man, one of these days I'm going to be able to do that. And that's kind of what sparked it.
I love that. I can't believe how fast he rides in real life. All you guys, you ride, like, faster than fast.
You know, Baker breathes expeditious behavior on the mountain. You know, you're buckling into your binding halfway up the checkpoint, you're just getting ready for that top of that lift to come. And as soon as you hit the snow, you're straight as fast as you can. You know, trying to follow Bass and Loeb and even Dave Price when he came down, you know, they'd fucking haul ass. They'd be ghosts. All you'd see is their vapor trail. They didn't want you to know where they were going.
That's it, right? They have their runs, and if you can keep up, you can ride with them. And if you can't keep up, then
exactly,
you have no idea where they went. How long into it before you started competing? Like, back in those days, competitions were few and far between, but were pretty much the only path to kind of like pro riding.
Yeah. You know, for sure, the early days were really instrumental in laying the groundwork for the fabric and the community that snowboarding now is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the early Northwest Series contests and then the West Beach contest, that was huge for developing like friendships and relationships that are stronger than ever today. And then, you know, for me going from a junior in a Northwest Series regional contest straight into a pro halfpipe contest down in Squaw Valley, I think probably winner 92 or 93, you know, that was a big jump. But it just seemed like the level of snowboarding and where it was at, there wasn't a big gap between what was on an amateur rank, what was going down wasn't too far away from what was happening in the pros.
I could see that.
Or at least that's how it felt, making the transition into that contest. Just I think that the placing on the first pro contest was, you know, top 10 or top 5 or something, and that's, it just seemed like a natural transition into it.
Did you know about Mervin before you were approached by Mike or Pete to ride for them?
Yeah, you know, I was versed in who they were because of Matt Cummins. You know, I started riding for Matt Cummins' shop, Northwest Snowboards, in probably 89. And if you rode for the shop, you got one free GNU snowboard a year. And that's what started my relationship with Mervin. But at the time, I didn't know that they were in the process of transitioning out of this, which was essentially Nitro and Windline Distribution that held the rights to the name GNU. And once they saw an opportunity to get out of that relationship and start something new, I had a choice. to either go, you know, I think Gwen Howlett from Mount Baker was the team manager at the time. And she, I remember calling me in and asking me if I wanted to ride for her, did I want to ride for Nitro, or did I want to go with this new company that was just a garage company that wasn't going anywhere, that was just, you know, fly by night. These guys might compete. They're going to start this company in Liptek. And really, I was following Matt Cummins' lead on a lot of stuff at that point in time, and also backing the decision to go with a company that was going to be based in my backyard, to have a close relationship that I could drive into the factory to pick up boards if I needed them, that I could talk to them face to face, and that we had the opportunity to grow together. You know, I was young. They were relatively new at the game themselves, and what a chance relationship now that has grown into something that's so tight and such a family bond that's stronger than it's ever been. And to have us grow up together and both work hard toward, you know, living a dream and finding some success and failure in that has been an unreal experience.
Liptek seems like they've got a track record of being the best company of supporting the riders that sign on.
What they do has truth to it, and those actions back that up. You know, Mike and Pete are, they honestly do their best to be righteous in all the right ways, to not only take care of the heritage and the just the family sense of knowing that those people worked hard with them to make it possible, you know, for them to be able to do the kind of things that they can do with their company, where they share that, you know, and that's rare. You know, I've never ever felt like a number on a roster. And a lot of times with people that I've talked to in different situations, that's all they feel like. And to me, it just builds a strength of loyalty and integrity that I want to give back to them, because I feel that in return.
Yeah, those guys are the best. You can just tell. Mike was talking about one day he just gave Pete half the company. They were on a road trip, and he could tell there's something up with Pete, and Pete was like, dude, you own everything. Like, it's all in your name. And Mike was like, oh, that bugs you?
Yeah.
And he just wrote on a piece of paper, I give him one half of the company. Whatever that means, it's half yours now, man.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
And he's always been that guy.
Yeah. Just want to facilitate the opportunity for him to continue being creative and artistic and doing what he truly has a passion for.
Yeah.
And that's a rare quality, especially this day and age. You know, not trying to make $1 million or millionaires out of what they do, but just, you know, I'm sure putting money in the bank helps pay taxes, but it's never been, they've always been horrible at it. And, you know, their track record of people that have bankrolled them, or, you know, and have got into it wanting to make money, like, you know, Quicksilver, for example, where they wanted to see a bottom line. And those guys, I've never seen them worry or sweat until they have to deal with money, because they hate it. They just want to go surf. They just want to skate. I know more often than not, I go and call Pete when I'm up in Seattle, and he'll meet me down at the skate park, and we'll skate for a couple hours together. That's where we do our business.
Right.
And to me, I couldn't think of a better round table to be able to handle business by doing Smith Grinds in the deep end of a pool.
There are so many people in the industry that saw it as like a way to make money. Mike and Pete had a huge influence on everything as far as deep side cuts go and nose and tail kicks. Like Peter was talking about how he tried to make his Division 23 board with the same kicks as your, I guess, probably the, like the whale board.
Those times and the opportunity that we had doing what we love is such a blessing. You know, the people that I've been able to meet and hang out with and still continue to have a killer relationship because of snowboarding, I'm nothing but thankful and just stoked every day that I get a chance to do it.
You took a bit of a hiatus from the spotlight, mid-90s, late-90s. Was that intentional? Was that...
Yeah.
Were you kind of burned out on snowboarding?
You know, it was a lot. It was never really a burnout on the act of snowboarding. It was always kind of an escape from myself and what I had created. You know, like I had built this pile of dirt, and I let, you know, it get to me in ways that resulted in going down into bad places and experiencing, you know, either drug addiction or thinking I needed to get married and start a family and doing that with someone that thought the same, but maybe it was just because that's what we thought we needed to do, and rushed into a relationship where I thought I was going to start a family, and it fell apart, and I ended up, you know, going through a lot of lessons of life and growing and growth periods through that are not always easy, but calm seas don't make a sailor, I guess. And what it did is it gave me perspective, and it gave me, like, humility, and it gave me the understanding that, man, I have something that I love that's out there that I've been blessed with the opportunity to do for a living, and I truly love it. And if I can still do it and still have the opportunity to not only grow and inspire for me, but do the same for others. Again, if I had that chance and I didn't take it, I'd feel like I was blowing a huge opportunity.
Yeah, I hear you. Did you ever consider another career path?
No, because I didn't have the desire to go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was still painting, and I was still doing art and contributing in certain ways in certain situations with companies just to keep relations or keep a connection, and still writing, but just never really doing it in front of cameras anymore, because that has started to eat away with the soul and the spirit of what I wanted it or needed it for. And I think now reapproaching it in a way and starting to, like, do more film and more photo stuff, it just gives me a little, just regulates, you know, what's for me and what's for that situation. You know, if I can keep that balance, then I'm doing all right. I know I can feel it.
Those early days of filming with MacDog, it seems like you got this really great time in snowboarding where the progression in TB2, for example, wasn't anything other than, like, you riding at your capacity at that time. You know, like, you could tell you're having a good time. You're riding these new parks that are just popping up in these resorts, and it looks like you're really enjoying yourself. I don't see that as much now, even with the great guys like Manboy's crew, and there's a little more stress in their crew. Like, oh, it's a good day. We need to get to the right zone.
Yeah.
Get there by the time the lighting's good. You know, like...
Yeah, you know, it's more of a responsibility, I think, for kids these days than it is just a true passion. Parents, coaches, agents, other people riding them to do something, be somebody, be somewhere. Not because they wanted to at that point in time, it's because someone's telling them, winding them up and pointing them in the right direction. Like, I've never had an agent. I had, it was a time before cell phones. You know, we had a phone number and a contact when we got to wherever we were going, and had to make that call using a calling card. You know, it was a different period. It was just, it was a lot more innocent.
Right.
And I think that innocence shows through the film and the photos. You know, we're living in the moment because there was no moment before us to tell us how to do it or why to do it or where to do it. You know, we're kind of figuring it out on our own. And I think there's a special quality experience that you can't replicate. You know, where I came from and the town that I grew up in, every time that I would come home, it would be like a really good grounding opportunity, because there was no one I could really share experience with that could relate to where I had been or what I had just experienced. So I always kind of kept that down. Didn't let that stuff go to my head much, but, you know, and every time I'd go to a competition, it was always going there to compete against myself, to prove it to myself that I could do the things that I needed to do to put my best foot forward and to have my best showing now. You know, but it was never going into an arena, looking at an opponent, going, I'm going to do whatever it takes to best that other person. You know, we didn't really need to do that in snowboarding. It was just do what you do at the highest level you can do it, and then see how that falls, you know, into the place.
You were the first megastar I can think of that was soft-spoken, you know what I mean? You were never...
I always thought the strongest voice that you could have is through your actions. You know, let them speak for themselves, and put that out there and allow people to interpret and write their own dialogue and make their own interpretation of what they, you know, what they see or what they've experienced with you. You know, I don't need to put words in their head. They can use their own imagination. You know, that's the beauty of having a brain.
And your actions were very loud, and you got a huge following very quickly. So, like, when you would travel to Japan, for example, you must have been mobbed by people.
You know, there were times when it was as close to just being outside of what I thought snowboarding would ever become, you know, into a more elevated public situation. But they're so humble and so nice and so courteous that even if you had 200, 300, 400 kids swarming to get an autograph, they're still doing it in a polite, regulated manner. And that's so rare for a society in any country, but Japan is one that, you know, I've been going over there for 26 years now and have grown up with a lot of those kids that I've met that long ago. And now they have kids that are 12 and, you know, 13 years old and ripping on a snowboard to continue that legacy. And to have them be riding one of my boards, you know how much of an honor and for me to see that. That not only have I been able to inspire my generation, but then have the opportunity to inspire the next through their parents. It's, you know, unreal.
That's so cool, man. What does a season for Jamie Lynn look like now? You seem like you're on the road.
Yeah,
all the
you
time.
Know, this year's been pretty nonstop. I've had a great start. I'm renting a room from Tex Davenport up in Glacier, so I'm trying to be home at Baker as much as possible when I am home. And then I had an early trip to Les Arcs, France for a Vans trip. Right now we're currently working on a Vans movie. That's a project that's been happening for the last 2 years. So we went out to Jackson Hole for that. Spent some time with Brian Iguchi, which is always a pleasure. He's an awesome dude and great brother, and we always have a good time riding together. Then that kind of led us up to Revelstoke. Our first went to a bald face trip that Volcom does every year to kind of work and develop on the outerwear program, which is just a great excuse to go ride powder at bald face. And then after bald face, Gucci and I went up to Revy and got a couple of days at Eagle Pass Heli, which was my first time up there. I can say it's truly an amazing spot with amazing group of guides that put you into some good stuff. Now, I just came off of a day with a funeral of a friend that passed, but last night I realized that I didn't have a wallet. My wallet had my passport in it and my credit cards and my driver's license. So all day I'm sitting here stressing, thinking, how am I going to get my butt back across the border and back home to the States? I already got an expired passport that was expired on the 2nd, the day after I got up here. How they let me across the border, I have no idea. But this morning when I woke up, I was stressing big time, thinking, man, what am I going to do? So I went down to Castle, went to the service. Right after the service was over, I get a call. My wallet was found in the chair of the Airbnb that we were staying at. My car keys that were lost in another camera bag was then found by another friend. The call was made. So when I thought all was lost, paradise regained.
That's incredible.
Now I have cleansed. So it's been quite an emotional roller coaster today.
Yeah, dude.
I'm stoked nonetheless.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear everything worked out that way. And are you going to get to ride Revy tomorrow? Revy's amazing.
Yeah, this whole zone is just, it's my first trip up here, and it's been quite an eye-opener. Just the expanse of all the ranges, the Selkirks, the Purcells, the Monashies. It's just a special concentration of snow and the terrain to be able to ride it. Those variables don't come together too often like it does in this area. I'm surprised it's taken this long to make it up here.
Yeah, Revy's got so much fall line, hey? Look into your career and what you're doing, I'm like, wow, it's still the same. He's still crashing at an Airbnb, riding with Brian in Jackson Hole. And I'm glad that it's not, you know, the rock star life of somebody who's just being flown around as this kind of boy in a bubble. You know, you're still following your passion. That's fucking so awesome.
Yeah, there's definitely a dirtbag sense to it just because I don't have that kind of budget. You know, not to say I would be doing it that way if I did. You know, and I'd be lying to say that I didn't. I wouldn't go up to Bobface and sleep on a dog mat in the corner of the cat barn just to get a chance to go and ride some powder. You know, they call me the lodge cat. They just leave a saucer of milk out for me and I find my way. But without the extension and graciousness of someone like Jeff Pensario that would allow me the opportunity to go up and to realize that kind of a dream. I know without that extension, I would never have that opportunity, and I'd never have the kind of coin that it takes to experience that. And for him to extend that, I'm, you know, beside myself on that just courtesy and kindness. And it allows me to get reconnect with something that is true and something that strikes a deep chord inside.
It seems like that's never far from what you're doing in your life. A lot of us are here wishing we could be that genuine in our lives.
I'd feel like I was cheating myself if it was any other way. It just wouldn't be right. You know, there's still people out there too that I know that are just they're going through an awakening of something that they've lost touch with. You know, and I think it's always going to be there. It's never going to go away. You know, those people that maybe have life happens whether you're ready or not, and sometimes it distracts from something that you truly love. And if there's anybody out there that, you know, that might think that they've lost touch with that, I want to be the first ones to tell them that it's still there. It's always going to be there. And I just have to maybe lower your expectations a little bit. But there's still something to connect to.
That is one of my most favorite things. If I've got a friend who was such a good snowboarder, you know, in the 90s, let's say, and then they've got all wrapped up with life, and then they come back out, and you see them enjoying their life like they haven't been enjoying it for the last however long it's been.
It's just like, welcome back, you know, we've been missing you.
Yeah, man, totally. Those cool fucking toe side, front side spins, where did those come from?
I think Chris Miller, for some reason, was an influence in front threes, the way he did them on a vert ramp. I just wanted to be able to, you know, I used to not wax the bottom of my board and get it as fuzzy as I could because I thought it gave me more tooth to grab off my toes to be able to do front threes. That's how backwards my thinking was back then. I mean, you wouldn't do it off your heels on a skateboard, would you? No. You kind of have to have that pop come off the balls underneath your feet. You know, you'd have to pop that ollie first before you could start the rotation.
Yeah.
Kind of coming from skateboarding.
Do you still skateboard a lot now?
Every day I can. Every day that's dry and the park's dry.
We didn't really talk too much about, or at all really, about your music or your art. And your art's been a big part of LibTech, actually.
We kind of developed that program trying to translate the kind of art I was doing at the time. You know, we tried to do it in a four-color process screen printing manner, and it just didn't translate. So then I think Mike Olson got a hold of Paul Schmidt. It was doing Channel One, and it was when all those full-color sublimation skate graphics were coming out on a sublimated, you know, top sheet printed backwards. And there are those big, like, collage of candies and matchstick guy and all those skate graphics. Also needed to find out how I pulled that off. And Paul Schmidt had sent up, like, two or three test skate graphic that were cut in probably 32-inch lengths. And Olson figured out how to plastic weld them together and made a top sheet out of one to see if it would adhere and not delaminate. But I have this board still to this day with all these Channel One and Schmidt skate graphics on it.
Rad.
And that was the first, you know, that's when we finally got an opportunity to do the whale graphic and the octopus graphic in watercolor. And that kind of changed the whole dynamic of what we knew as board graphics for LibTech.
just imagining Paul Schmidt and Mike Olson in a conversation.
So yeah, the two industries. No doubt.
They're both kind of the same personality, just like so keen on experimenting and figuring shit out.
Yeah, development, research, and just problem solving. He's almost like on a different level mentally, that it works much faster and has many more volumes than mere mortals. The way he thinks, he's always thinking to better what's out there.
He's excited like a kid about inventing things and about snowboarding.
I think his ability to actually manufacture his ideas and build his dream of what he was thinking and then develop that through research and development. There's not many people that could have all that and be able to apply it and pull it off the way he did.
And to think that he was there side by side while Jake was doing it, Tom was doing it, Chuck was doing it. All those guys were doing it, and he is still doing it now.
I think it was a special time for all of us to be a part of something that we love so much and to share that passion and to build what we've been able to lay down the foundation that people are now using to build off of. That's a huge honor. Very thankful.
Is there anyone you want to give shout-outs to?
Everyone that's ever helped facilitate my dream of doing something that I truly love. Take the opportunity to say thank you.
Thanks so much for getting in touch with me.
Well, Eric, thank you.
good luck, Carl.
You have a great evening and a safe passage out there.
Yeah.
I'll keep in touch. And if I make it up there or if you make it down to Baker, my door is always open.
All right, brother. Fucking right. Good to talk with you, man. Thanks a lot.
No problem, man. Take care, man. Have a good evening.
Yeah, you too. See you, man. What a rad snowboarder. I hope you listeners liked that interview. I can't even believe it's the end of season 2. A humongous thank you to all our guests this year, and special thanks to everyone who listens. I'm having a ton of fun interviewing the snowboarders I grew up idolizing. As of right now, I'm totally gathering intel on guests for a third season, and some of you loyal listeners will remember I promised a Craig Kelly episode on his birthday. I'm going to whip together a little tribute, but I haven't been able to get all the interviews that I feel are necessary to tell a complete story, and it's a lot more work than I originally planned, so it won't be the finished Craig Kelly episode, but it'll be something. So here's the last thing for this season. I'm thinking of doing a recurring segment called Are You a Snowboarder? Here's a sample of how it would work.
Are you a snowboarder or are you not? Are you part of the club or are you not?
I'm going to ask you, have you ever something for snowboarding?
Okay.
And then you try and ask me one that kind of one-ups that, if you can do it. So, like, you ever been on the first chair of the season? Like,
absolutely opening not. Chair?
You haven't?
No.
Oh.
No.
All right, you got one for me?
Have you ever fallen into a tree well head first?
Yes, I have. A couple times.
Okay, me too.
That's a shitty one. All right, how about this one?
It isn't shitty.
Yeah, it is the worst. When you hit the tree and the snow falls down, it's like filling up like so fast.
Yeah, and you think you're dying. Totally. There's like 4 inches of snow on you.
Exactly. Have you ever showed up at a staff party in your snowboard gear?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I showed up at many parties in my snowboard gear.
Yeah.
I don't know, but staff party, but yes. Head to toe, boots, goggles, whole thing. Have you ever gotten too stoked while riding out of bounds and didn't turn back soon enough?
Yes, at Baker.
Okay. Where'd you end up?
Okay.
You had to walk all the way to chair 8 or something?
It was like an hour workout. All right, here's my last one. Have you ever gotten on and off the chairlift with the wrong foot strapped in?
No.
Dude, it's the worst.
But I went up snowboarding with a girl who tried to do that one. Cool, man.
Right on. Thanks, Russell.
Yeah, late.
So if you like this idea, comment on the episode anywhere you find it with your own Have You Ever question, and I'll read the best ones out in future podcasts. Thanks for listening. Be sure to come back on Craig Kelly's birthday for a special episode of the F and Rad Snowboarding Podcast, brought to you by Bike Room Productions.